From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. This Sunday, a CBS News YouGov poll found that just 36% of respondents believed U.S. efforts to deal with the coronavirus pandemic were going well. When looking at the virus long term, Dr. Anthony Fauci, a top medical advisor to President Biden, recently said we're still in the first of what he considered to be five phases in the pandemic. This first phase being the, quote, truly pandemic phase, followed by deceleration, control, elimination, and eradication. Though the coronavirus, like many other infectious diseases, may never be truly gone, it could one day be lumped in among colds and flus and other illnesses that at least most of us can live with. Until then, a majority of Americans continue to exercise some form of caution against coronavirus disease, and that means we have questions about vaccines, long COVID, and the future of the pandemic. We had overwhelming response to our conversation on COVID last week, including with a pair of virologists based here in Illinois. So today we have them back to help answer more of your COVID questions. Joining us again is Professor Edward Campbell, a virologist in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the Stritch School of Medicine at Loyola University, Chicago. Edward, welcome back to The 21st.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good to see you again.
Also joining us, Professor Deepak Shukla, professor of virology at the University of Illinois Chicago College of Medicine. He's authored many articles on SARS-CoV-2. Deepak, welcome back to The 21st to you as well.
Glad to be back.
Listeners, our lines are again open for this segment. What questions do you have for our guest virologists? Are you confused about immunity? Do you have questions about long COVID and how the virus is mutating? You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21ST Show. So I'm going to begin with a question, some questions about infection and transmission. So Omicron has, I think, erroneously been referred to as a milder variant, right? We're seeing a lot of serious illness, particularly among the unvaccinated. Edward Campbell, what do you think of the, you know, this idea that some people have out there, might as well get it now, get it over with, sentiment you see from some people out there?
Well, I think right now, given the state of most hospitals in the area, is actually a really bad time to get infected with coronavirus. It's also a really bad time because of the surge that hospitals are experiencing. It's a bad time to have a heart attack. It's a bad time to have any number of medical issues just because the capacity of our healthcare system is being strained to its limits. In general, you know, you probably don't want to think of it being a good day to get an Omicron infection. But if you were to think along those lines, I definitely don't think it's today, because if you end up in the hospital, you could end up with in a resource limited setting because of all of the other people in the hospital.
And is there, what do you think of this idea that it is a, you know, quote unquote, milder variant? Is it just that there's more people in the population who are vaccinated now and, you know, or have prior infections and some immunity from that? Or is there something that is innately different about this version of the SARS-CoV-2?
So I think there's data on both sides. There's good data that seems to suggest that the tropism of Omicron might be slightly different in tissue culture or animal models. And that correlates with some studies that have been done, or at least looking at the epidemiology of the virus in patients. Now, I would say that the patients' studies are the ones that are the most important. And there, I don't think there's a uniform agreement on. And minimally, if Omicron is less pathogenic or less likely to cause severe disease, the sheer number of people getting infected in, you know, you're not seeing that at the hospital level just because of the sheer number of patients.
Deepak Shukla, can I ask you, what does natural, I know that some people are wary of this term, this idea of natural immunity, but let's say immunity derived from an infection, from somebody who has recovered from COVID-19. Why does that only last for a few months versus, you know, other viruses out there like chickenpox, right? Where maybe somebody's only going to get that once in their lifetime.
So, yeah, I think there are fundamental differences between viruses. So when you mention chickenpox, it's a DNA virus and it's not changing its structure as frequently as, you know, coronavirus, that the one that we are dealing with right now. It's an RNA virus, and RNA by design is more prone to making mistakes, which helps the virus in terms of acquiring different, you know, conformation over time. And that's a big advantage that goes in favor of this particular virus that we are dealing with right now, SARS-CoV-2. So I think the immunity, again, you know, has different facets. As you know, innate immunity is non-specific, but the recent data coming out from different labs would suggest that even innate immunity could be specific, depending on and the tissue and, of course, the pathogen. And likewise, the adaptive immunity that lasts forever. But if the virus, like flu, if it's changing its conformation, and we saw in this case that spike protein has a lot of mutations, that means a different conformation. So antibodies for sure are not going to be as controlling as one would expect. And that's one of the reasons why people lose immunity against this virus over time.
Interesting. So, Edward Campbell, there was a paper that came out recently suggesting that, and this is more getting into some of the testing questions that are out there, but it suggested that the viral load found by PCR tests, and I guess the technical term for this is RNA copy number, that's what the PCR test is measuring, that it doesn't really correlate with whether someone is infectious. And correct me if I'm misinterpreting this, but I wonder if this is suggesting that, you know, what PCR tests, the main tests that, you know, when you get the thing shoved up your nose or now in some cases down your throat, what they're looking for, it doesn't really measure whether someone is infectious to others, or maybe is not the best measure of whether someone is infectious to others. Do I have that right? And what are the implications for how we are approaching testing for this virus?
Right. Well, so not to get too far down in the weeds, and I know that this was a paper that was covered on TWIV, which I think I know you listened to from my last visit. That is generally true of what the paper showed, but to get a little bit into the details, what they did is they only analyzed samples with higher viral loads. And why did they do that? Because previous work had shown that they couldn't culture infectious virus from samples that had a lower viral load. So if they had, and first of all, I love this study. I think it was a heroic and important effort, and there's a lot of important data in there. I was a little bit surprised by the focus on the TWIV group, and also kind of in the punchline of this paper to talk about this lack of correlation between viral load and infectivity, when they just come out and say, oh, we only looked at samples below that had above a certain viral load, because that's when we can culture virus. And then when they took those high viral load samples, they didn't really see a strong correlation. There was a modest correlation. But if they had extended that out to lower viral load samples, certainly that correlation would have been better. So I think that part of the paper was not my favorite part of that paper.
Interesting. Yeah, you definitely caught me. I'm not a virologist, but I do enjoy listening to the podcast of them, and maybe at my peril. If you put too much stock in any one interpretation of this sort of research, I mean, one of the things that paper said, though, is that, you know, maybe the, you know, they were still detecting infectious virus 5 days after the onset of symptoms, raising questions about, you know, the idea of the CDC ending isolation after 5 days. I wonder what you think of that.
That, I think, was one of the strongest take-homes of that paper. You know, I think the wording they use is we were still able to detect infectious virus in about 53% of the vaccinated subjects, indicating that it might be beneficial to not shorten to 5 days as recently recommended by the CDC. And I think looking at this data, that is, as gently as you could put, a very strong point of this paper.
So if I'm allowed to jump in, because please. Look at the Omicron, the sample size is very low. This is an important point to notice, because they had only 18 subjects. So I think the sample size is too low to make a, you know, conclusion here, in my opinion.
Do you think, Deepak, that we will be moving away from PCR tests into antigen or some other form of testing for, I guess, more epidemiological purposes, right, for people getting back into society and making decisions about their lives?
I think so for multiple reasons. So one, what the study shows that, you know, there's a poor correlation, and also it takes, you know, longer to do PCR. So I think in reality, I think we'll be probably better off using more, you know, direct antigen type tests than PCR.
Sure. And they're still hard to find, I know, in a lot of places, though. I'm sure almost everybody out there listening now has gotten text messages or heard about in some way that the U.S. government has put up on the Postal Service website. You can go sign up and get some tests mailed to you if you want. 4 tests per residential address, I think, is how they're doing that. I signed up yesterday. We can put a link to that on our website if you have not heard about that or gotten a link sent to you, as I did from many different people in text messages yesterday. Let me read a text from one of our listeners. Randy said, asked about how soon will a saliva-based test be on the market? And Randy said, I believe the saliva test is widely seen as more reliable and a much more scientific method for testing since it has near 100% trust. Why are they not everywhere? He says in caps. Where can I get them? Deepak Shukla, what is the accuracy difference? I mean, is there an accuracy difference between the nasal swab test, a saliva test, and maybe you can answer his question?
No, I agree in this case, especially with Omicron, and during the days when you're most infectious, you can definitely see more virus in saliva. So for this particular strain of coronavirus, in my opinion, saliva is a better test. But then again, depends currently. The one that UIC, for example, is running is still a PCR-based assay. And that's where the problem comes. I'm not sure, when this is going to be more frequently available. But for this particular strain, I do agree that saliva could be a better choice, especially if you want to figure out if the person is infectious or not.
Edward, another one of our listeners texted asking, how do we know what a virus looks like? And another one asked if a virus is a living thing. I wonder if you can respond to that.
Oh, sure. I mean, these are maybe more philosophical and almost fun questions, right? So the virus, to figure out what it looks like, you have to use a form of microscopy called electron microscopy. And this is a great question for coronavirus because the spike protein that we've heard so much about compared to other viruses is kind of this large globular ornate structure that decorates a coronavirus. And in fact, it looks like a crown, which is why it's called a coronavirus. So it has some pretty unique and interesting features by electron microscopy that make it stand out from other viruses. In terms of is a virus alive, this is the kind of thing that, we scientists enjoy, like drinking beers and fighting over. So I don't think there's a great answer. But, I think in terms of is something alive, if it's able to propagate its genetic information, if that's the only criteria, then yes, a virus is alive. Normally, the caveat to that would be, can I propagate my genetic information independently? And because viruses, unlike bacteria, they require a host cell, and they always use the host cell's machinery, if you will, to replicate. The people that argue against a virus being a living thing usually rely on that specific fact that a virus needs a host cell to replicate, so then it doesn't meet the qualifications of being alive. But I think it's subjective. It's kind of like the is NASCAR a sport kind of a thing, because you're using a car. You could come down on either side.
Turning left for 200 miles.
Right.
Deepak Shukla, let me ask you, though, one more question before we have to take a break, maybe. And this is getting back to the question of immunity. I wonder, for people who are, let's say, fully vaxxed and boosted, and they get COVID, which we're seeing a lot more people doing in this Omicron wave, do they have a sort of a super immunity, and how long might that last?
Super immunity would protect better, in my opinion, than giving them symptoms. But I think it's something that depends on the nature of virions. But what I have noticed, and I think ever since Omicron came about, the Delta has disappeared. So definitely Omicron is the permissibility rate is only 1/3 less for Delta, but it's almost all gone. So looks like Omicron is providing very good immunity even against Delta. And that's something, you know, gives me optimism that, you know, in near future, hopefully the virus will become endemic.
Interesting. Yep. All right, let's put a pause on that. I want to dig a little deeper into that when we come back. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st. We're speaking with a pair of virologists from Illinois. Deepak Shukla is professor of virology at the UIC College of Medicine. Edward Campbell is a professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the Stritch School of Medicine at Loyola University, Chicago. If you want to join our conversation, if you have a question, if you've always wanted to ask a virologist something, 800-222-9455 is the number to call us now. 800-222-9455. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. Later in the program today, we'll be talking we'll get away from COVID, take a break from that, and talk with a curator from the Illinois State Museum about an exhibit they're planning on Generation X. That's all coming up after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking about COVID-19 with a pair of virologists from Illinois. Deepak Shukla is professor at the UIC College of Medicine, and Edward Campbell is a professor at the Stritch School of Medicine at Loyola University. And we're taking your calls at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And Deepak Shukla, before the break, we were talking about the idea that Omicron has edged out Delta in terms of the virus. And you said that was making you, I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but optimistic that we may be entering a different phase of the pandemic where it will be more endemic and less of a pandemic. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit?
So, yeah, it's very interesting that, you know, Delta with the 1/3 transmissibility rate is almost all gone. And in my opinion, it's happening because for two reasons. One is, of course, the Omicron is highly transmissible. But in addition, it's generating immunity. And the data shows very clearly now that the immunity that Omicron generates is very protective against Delta. The reverse is not true. The Delta, of course, immunity against Delta can be overshadowed by Omicron, but not the reverse. So looks like this virus is acting like a live virus vaccine. People, not to get the virus, but just in general, people who have gotten it definitely have developed better immunity, for example, against Delta, which in result, you know, eliminating Delta from the population.
Okay, I think I follow that. Let's go now to the phones. Ken is calling on line 4 from Champaign. Ken, thank you for calling in.
Thank you so much for the show and your guests. I'm interested to, they could speak to the medium for transmission. I read somewhere that Omicron might be more transmissible via solid surfaces as opposed to air. So if your guests could speak to the medium and if it is air or other alternatives. Thank you so much. I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for that question. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about you all, but during the early days of the pandemic, I was wearing gloves around and I pretty much stopped doing that and am not, you know, we don't see as much hand sanitizer quite everywhere as we did in the early days because we were told transmission on surfaces isn't really a big thing. Edward Campbell, do you have a perspective on whether Omicron is more of a surface concern than we've had up to this
right,
point?
So I haven't seen studies showing that. I would say that in general, what was pretty clear from the beginning and, you know, ultimately studies confirmed is that really it is respiratory droplets that are temporarily airborne. And I think the way to really nail that down just from a logical perspective for your listeners is if it was a fomite, which means, oh, I touched my nose or stuck my fingers in my mouth and touched a doorknob and then someone else touched that doorknob, children would be the world heavyweight champions of transmitting COVID, just like they are all of the other viruses that are transmitted in that way, right? Because they do disgusting things with their fingers and hands. And really, we're seeing that children don't transmit nearly as well as adults. And I think that really speaks to the fact that it's not a fomite or surface kind of contact. But with Omicron, I'd have to look into the literature, but I haven't seen any studies saying that it's different.
All right. Thank you for that call. We appreciate it. Tina is on line one from Bloomington. Tina, thank you for calling in.
Hi. I would have read a lot about people taking vitamin C, vitamin D, and zinc if they contract COVID. Could you speak to herbal or vitamin remedies?
Okay, thank you for that question, Tina. I know neither of you are physicians, but I wonder if you have a perspective on that, Deepak Shukla, in terms of any sort of herbal approach if somebody does get COVID.
So, I mean, it definitely seemed to provide some benefit. I mean, I don't know whether it's significant or not, but studies have shown zinc, for example, has some antiviral effect. It doesn't hurt. Definitely doesn't hurt. Whether it provides a clear-cut benefit, I'm not sure.
Okay. And Edward Campbell, I wonder if you have a perspective on that as well.
Yeah, I would say the exact same thing. Okay. Like vitamin D is known to enhance immune system function. You know, is that the same as having, you know, the new direct antiviral from Pfizer that targets a viral enzyme, which is really the same way we keep HIV in check? No. And you'd rather have the second one. But if you're asking, will that hurt or help? It could only help. It's probably not going to help that much. You should still probably seek professional medical care. But those things, you know, they all add up. There's a lot of things you can do that associate with less severe disease, right? That, you know, you see like people take, you know, Viagra. People that take Viagra tend to have less severe disease. Does that mean it's a treatment? Again, I'd rather have the Pfizer drug.
You know, let's talk about that. Actually, this is, I think, Paxlovid is what it's called, the one you're referring
right to.
And it's been approved. It's still being rolled out pretty slowly. I understand it's being rationed pretty tightly. Can you just talk about how that works? What's in it? How does it work to fight off the virus?
Sure. Well, so this kind of drug, what it does is it targets a viral enzyme that has to do the same job thousands of times or millions of times to make infectious virions from a cell. And targeting enzymes has been a strategy that this is really the kind of treatment or therapies that are used to prevent people that are HIV positive from progressing towards AIDS. So they're highly effective and they're very precisely molecularly targeting a specific protein. And at that level of mechanistic understanding, drugs like that have a great track record. Viruses will still evolve resistance to these kinds of things over time. And that happens to some degree with HIV, but compared to something like, a vitamin D or a Viagra treatment in the short term, they are, the data on Paxlovid is really just phenomenal.
Interesting. And so, I mean, let me try a metaphor here. I like to do this every now and then at my peril. But, if the virus is a key and our bodies are a lock, I mean, is this like, you know, getting some super glue in there, preventing the, you know, the virus from sort of getting in and doing what it needs to do in terms of replicating? Or how do you think?
I think if one were looking for an analogy like that, the best one to think about it is a virus when it's replicating is a big factory and it has all of these wheels and gears turning. And what a drug like this does is really throws a monkey wrench in one of those gears and stops it from spinning, that basically shuts down the entire assembly line.
Okay. Let me go to line two now. Mike is calling in from Peoria. Mike, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the subject. It's very important to the world, actually, right now. But I've two questions. One, is there any truth to CBD oil reducing the replication of the virus? And then the second one, my daughter, Macy, who's 6 years old, got a vaccine on Friday. And so yesterday morning, she woke up with a bit of a cough. Later on, had a temperature of 100. We took a home test, one of those free home tests, and she turned up to be positive. So is there possibly confusion with with the shot that you got that could be causing this positive reaction?
Okay, good question. Let's take those in reverse orders. And thank you for the call, Mike. And I'm sorry to hear about your child. I hope she's feeling better soon. Deepak Shukla, any chance of getting a vaccine and then having a false or a positive related to that? Or is it, you know, just probably caught COVID along, you know, at the same time they got the vaccine?
I think, they caught COVID along because they're two different things. So the vaccine is against the spike protein, whereas when you run the test for the infection, you are looking at different set of proteins. So I don't think that the vaccine would give her, there is any chance the vaccine itself would give her the disease or infection.
Okay. And Edward Campbell, I'll let you take the, I think, I'm trying to remember something about CBD oil in terms of the which I have to admit is something I see advertisements for everywhere, and I have really no idea what it is other than it has something to do with cannabis. But
right. And I think, you know, there's a lot of research showing that this is an anti-inflammatory kind of an effect that CBD oils have. So in terms of some of the symptoms, I wouldn't expect it to be directly antiviral. But in many cases, the disease that one experiences is really more the symptoms than the virus. So I think it's probably falling into the category of the same thing we were talking about with, say, vitamin D or Viagra. Just since the person asked the question, I was kind of Googling MedArchive and BioArchive, and superficially, there do seem to be some studies that show, a positive benefit. It's not a profoundly positive benefit, but I think it would probably fall again into the it probably couldn't hurt kind of category.
So to be clear, treating the symptoms the way you would with a Advil or Tylenol or something like that, but not treating, you know, going after the virus itself as
right.
This
it's
new
not
pill
going to,
from Pfizer,
you know,
would do. Yeah.
When you think of zinc or vitamin D, you're usually enhancing immune function, right? And this would be a little bit different. But, you know, Viagra is not directly antiviral and it's having a positive effect. So, you know, here I would definitely consult your physician and see if that kind of option is right for you, because this is an emerging these studies are not even published yet from what I can see, but, you know, if at face value, they seem to kind of fall into the category of treatments we've been talking about.
About 6 minutes left in our conversation with Edward Campbell and Deepak Shukla, two virologists from Illinois, 800-222-9455, if you want to try and get in the next few minutes. I want to move now to long COVID, the tail phase of the COVID-19 infection. Edward Campbell, if a person gets even a mild case of Omicron, I guess it could still lead to long COVID. Can you talk about that? Is that, I know we're still in early days in terms of the Omicron variant and infections from that, but is this something that still should be a concern for people?
Oh, absolutely. And people are studying right now as we speak to understand long COVID. You know, when we think of COVID and going to the hospital, right, almost in every case, we think about the damage that COVID can do to the lungs and the respiratory failure or the acute respiratory distress it can cause. But it seems clear that there can be other tissue targets of COVID in the body, and how, you know, those cell types or organs are affected could be contributing to long COVID. I have a friend studying at Northwestern looking at, COVID infection in macaques, and he sees a tremendous infection in male genitals, which correlates to reports of erectile dysfunction and sterility in males after infection. Now, there's still a lot of work to be done, but, you know, minimally that would, if I needed any prompting to go get the vaccine, that would probably be it, because, you might live through your infection or not have to go to the hospital, but that would be a tremendous sacrifice, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I've heard it phrased earlier in the pandemic, death is not the only endpoint about which to be worried with
exactly.
COVID-19. Deepak Shukla, what do we know? Does the potential for long COVID change depending on the severity of a person's original infection? Is there anything we understand about that today?
I mean, the data doesn't exist because Omicron just started like in December. So sure. I think it'll take, you know, several months before we know for sure But given the infection rate and the ability of this virus to affect the nerves, I think there may be some issues that might linger over time, even with Omicron, but we don't know for sure right now.
One of our listeners texted asking, very simply, when will this ever end? Deepak Shukla, as we're coming to the end of our conversation, from a virology standpoint, when is the closest the COVID-19 pandemic could be to ending, or at least minimizing, and how could we get there?
So as I said earlier, I think 2022 is the year most likely, because the virus, given the Omicron is acting like a live virus vaccine. And I was just saying earlier that it's already, you know, protecting us against Delta. So I think with most people getting the Omicron virus, I think it's going to become endemic, and I see an end to this pandemic for sure. I could be wrong, but that's how I feel.
All right, Edward Campbell, what about you? Do you when will this ever end? And I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, no, I'll echo those sentiments, and I would say I'm reasonably optimistic. You know, the trend for Omicron right now, and you know, in terms of the hospitalization rate or everything, it's just spreading so fast that most of us will end up with some level of immunity. And you know, the reality is that there's four or five seasonal coronaviruses that are related to COVID that Deepak and I know about, and you don't, because you don't care. They cause the common cold. And these were basically domesticated viruses that have undergone you know, probably an evolutionary process where in the beginning, when they splashed into humans, they caused the same kind of trauma, and now we've learned to live with them. And I'm hopeful that, especially with Omicron, we can get to the same place with COVID-19.
And not just learned in terms of human behavior, but you mean our immune systems have learned.
Exactly.
To
look at that. And more. Yeah. I don't think we're doing a very good job in terms of our learning behavior, in terms of our, at the people level, but our immune systems are doing a much better job.
Are we one variant though away from, you know, we talked about whether Omicron is maybe able to evade the immune response we've had so far. Are we just another variant away from this taking another turn for the worse, potentially?
I don't think that's implausible. But what you have to realize is these variants are all based off of the same genetic code. And for example, the reason Omicron is able to infect people that are vaccinated or have been infected is it can circumvent the antibody response. But there's still cellular immunity mediated by T cells, which are really the reason that we see that vaccinated people are asymptomatic or barely symptomatic with this virus. And there's so many T cell epitopes, as it were, targets of T cells in coronavirus, that you'd have to do a lot more than vary to make all of that go away. So I think once everyone has a level of that T cell based immunity, you know, it's not over and anything could happen, but I think we'll be in a okay spot, as Deepak says.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for sharing your knowledge and expertise and time with us today on the 21st. Edward Campbell is professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the Stritch School of Medicine at Loyola University Chicago. Deepak Shukla is professor of virology at the UIC College of Medicine. Thank you both so much for being with us today on the show.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
For inviting us.
Coming up after a short break, we're going to be talking with a curator from the Illinois State Museum about a new exhibit they're putting together on Generation X. It's coming later this year, but now they are looking for members of that generation to help contribute stories, photos. We're going to talk about that after the break. Stay with us.